You're listening to a 95BFM podcast. Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Except this week it's not Andrew Little. Unfortunately, the minister's mother has passed away this week, and from all of us at 95BFM, we pass on our condolences, and we really do hope he'll be back on the show with us in the near future. This week we've got the Minister for Police, Fisheries, Revenue and Small Business, Stuart Nash. He's talking to me about the government's wellbeing budget. We're a week out from budget day. Are there going to be any surprises? Plus, a new report has revealed Parliament is a toxic workplace with a systemic bullying problem. What does Minister Nash make of all of that? Have a listen. Good morning, Minister. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Stuart. How are you?
I'm good. Now, just to distinguish, different spelling. That's how we can get away with the two Stuarts.
Well, that's okay. I won't tell if you don't.
Firstly, I'd like to turn to the budget. We're a week out from budget day, which is always an exciting day for us in the media. Can you tell me, what is a wellbeing budget?
Okay, well, it's basically a different way of looking at how the government prioritises resources and money and what it invests in. So in the past, what sort of happened is Cabinet has agreed a broad set of priorities, and these have guided the budget decisions. There's been a heavy emphasis on measuring GDP. So, you know, in the past we've said if we've got a strong economy, things are going well. What we've done this time is we've taken a much more holistic approach and said, okay, of course GDP is an important measure, but also the health and well-being of our communities is also really important. You know, we used to hear this term rockstar economy, where we had great rates of growth, but there are huge swathes of our population that were going backwards. So this is sort of looking at intergenerational well-being, if that sort of makes sense, as opposed to just economic measures.
So are not all budgets well-being budgets then?
No, not at all. This is a different approach. Let me give you one example in my area. So in my area as Minister of Police, I've worked very closely with Andrew Little as the Minister of Justice, Kelvin Davis as the Minister of Corrections, Jan Logie as the Undersecretary for Domestic and Sexual Violence, Apito Williams-Seo in his role as Associate Justice. And we've had a look at a holistic approach to the justice sector and said, okay, in terms of all the budget we control in our ministerial responsibilities, where is it best to invest so we can have a real prevention focus, as opposed to Kelvin in corrections just saying, okay, I need a prison, so I need a whole lot of money to build that prison. Me saying, okay, I need a whole lot of police. And Andrew saying, I need more, you know, judges. And then we're going into a contestable process with the Minister of Finance. So we sort out beforehand what we think is the best mix to really drive change in the justice sector and present a sort of consolidated and coordinated budget bid. So I hope that sort of makes sense, but it really is a lot more of a holistic approach to how we view how we spend taxpayers' money.
So when you say you don't just need a whole lot of police, you kind of do, though, don't you? Aren't you looking for 1,800?
I know I do, but it's not an isolation of everything else. So, you know, one of our main goals is to reduce Maori recidivism, for example. One of our major goals is to reduce family violence. I mean, police attend over 130,000 cases every year of family violence. So we work with Jan, I work with Kelvin and Andrew to say, okay, in terms of the programs we're running and the pilots that we've got out there and the initiatives we want to try, how best do we invest our resources that are going to allow my police to take on the prevention model, Kelvin to reduce the prison numbers, Jan Logie to say, okay, this is the best outcome in terms of reducing sexual and domestic violence. So there are a whole lot of really important conversations, and in the end we come up with a package in the justice sector that we think is best to optimise that whole process, if that makes sense, as opposed to me just saying Kel doesn't need his prison, or Jan doesn't need money for domestic and sexual violence. I need my police in isolation of everything else. It's really a joined up approach, I suppose, is the best way to describe it.
So are you happy with what you've gained for your portfolios in the budget?
I'd always like more, of course. but you know, I'm happy with the direction of travel that we're taking as a government. And when I say that, of course, you know, a strong economy is important, because when businesses are doing well, they create wealth, they create jobs. But it's also just as important that that our communities are seeing benefit in what we are doing. So it really is a joined-up, holistic approach to the way we look at the health and well-being of the country as a whole, as opposed to just a strong economic focus around GDP.
After next week's budget, there's only one more in this term. Do you think you've upheld your obligations to New Zealand First and the Green Party?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. What we have tried to do is say, okay, we couldn't do everything in the first budget, which was last year, obviously. The second budget is the second in three, as you've highlighted, in terms of changing the whole settings. And the third one, I think, it will be the final budget in terms of delivering everything we've promised to the people of New Zealand. It, you know, I'm the first to admit that what we have tried to do has really been aspirational, certainly in my area. I know Grant Robertson, as the Minister of Finance, is always aspirational. And so, you know, what's tended to happen in the past, and history will bear this out, is that national governments tend to be managerial, whereas Labor governments or Labor-led governments have tended to be sort of evolutionary, if not revolutionary, in the way we do things. And, you know, sometimes that has a completely different approach to just saying, okay, things are going well, we're going to be incremental. We've tried to do things a lot differently, but we believe that that'll provide a better outcome for all New Zealanders.
So by the end of next year's budget, you reckon you will have ticked off all of those boxes for the two parties that you work alongside?
Well, what we will try to do is certainly put in place a number of processes that will allow us to achieve what we want to achieve. I mean, we're always working closely with our coalition and support partners, and it's not just at budget time. I mean, you know, in my areas, my fishing portfolio, I work very closely with the Minister of Conservation, Eugenie Sage. I work very closely with Winston Peters. In fact, the Deputy Prime Minister and myself are off to the Cook Islands to talk about fisheries very soon. And so it's not just at budget time we come together and determine, you know, what the state of the government looks like. It's sort of a business as usual day to day occurrence. But, you know, we won't have built 100,000 houses, of course, but we will have put the processes in place which will allow us to achieve that. So I think it's changing the fundamental settings of how government does things, and I think that will put us in really good stead heading into the future.
One of your obligations to New Zealand First is to investigate a rural volunteer police force. What's happened to that announcement?
Well, what we've done is we've had a look at the difference that rolling out 1,800 police will make to our community. So what happened is Ron Mark in opposition, who was their New Zealand's first police spokesperson, and I did a lot of work around what was happening to policing in the rural and provincial New Zealand. And numbers were being cut, gangs were taking control, methamphetamine was rampant, and thought, okay, what's the best way to do this? So the rural constabulary idea was New Zealand's first idea. But after sitting down and saying, hey, you know what, if we can actually roll out these 1,800 police, that will really make a big difference. You know, rural New Zealand really did suffer through cuts to road policing, for example. The last government cut 111 road policing. We increased those by July last year. So it's not just saying, hey, we're here to service the big cities. We're here to service the whole country. And so that's, you know, we just think rolling out 1,800 more police into rural and provincial New Zealand, as well as the big cities, will probably negate the need for a separate constabulary.
But we haven't got those 1,800 yet either, so are we going to even get to helping the rural regions out with those police numbers at all?
Oh, absolutely. So far since we've been in government, there's over 1,300 men and women who have graduated out of police college. And that equates to about 650 more police over and above numbers when we came into government. And if you consider that between 2012 and 2017, so the last 5 years of the previous government, police numbers actually fell by 70. And that was at a point where gangs were becoming more organised, methamphetamine was out of control, crime resolution rates were dropping. And police officers were feeling less satisfied with the work they were doing. And they said in their surveys that they just weren't meeting the expectation. Over 60% said they weren't meeting the expectation they were making to the public, and over 60%, and this is in the 2017 survey, said that they had an undue level of workplace stress. And so we're addressing this in a way that no government ever has in the past. But, you know, we'll get there. We also, of course, had the Provincial Growth Fund, which was a massive economic boost and is turning out to be to rural and regional New Zealand. So there are a lot of initiatives that we think will make the lives of provincial and rural New Zealanders a lot better than they were beforehand.
I'd like now to turn to that review into bullying in Parliament this week, which some quite major revelations in that about MPs and staffers across the board. Are you a bully minister?
No, I'm not. It's not how I conduct my life or manage my my office in any way, shape, or form. In fact, I have no time for bullying. I never did. You know, from my school days all the way through to different jobs and roles I've held, I think that cowards bully people.
Do you know any MPs who you think might be bullies, might be the ones referenced in that report?
Well, I don't know the MPs. Well, you know, we're making an assumption that some of the very serious allegations were MPs. They could well have been senior staffers. You know, I've seen some behaviour that's made me feel uncomfortable, but nothing of a sexual assault nature, and certainly nothing of a serious sexual assault nature that the you know, that has really captured the imagination of the media. But you know, I that sort of behaviour is totally unacceptable in my view. It doesn't matter what position you're in, and you know, some people say, well, it's a stressful job. Well, that is no excuse. New Zealanders work in stressful jobs every single day up and down this country. And there is never any excuse for bullying, but certainly we've got to be intolerant of any sort of sexual assaults or unwanted sexual advances. And it's really up to, you know, to all New Zealanders, but certainly men, to call that sort of behaviour out when we see it.
Are MPs treated like gods with a master-servant relationship?
Well, you know, you will find that some MPs think that they're better than other people, but I've never viewed that, and I've never thought that in any way, shape or form. In fact, the analogy I've always used is an airplane. I mean, MPs may be the pilots because, you know, we tend to be out front of the political process, but without the engineers and the stewards and everyone else, the plane never ever gets off the ground. So, you know, when you talk about politics, you may talk about MPs, but goodness me, we're just a very small piece on a very large machine that keeps the wheels of democracy turning.
Is there too much drinking in Parliament?
There certainly used to be. Of that, there's no doubt. And you hear stories from the 1980s where it tended to be just, you know, it seemed like just one big beer fest. But I haven't seen that at all. You know, I myself have taken a policy that I have two glasses of wine, because you know, you just can't operate in this environment hungover in any way, shape or form. But it's just about being sensible. So, you know, I certainly haven't seen evidence of excessive drinking here. But you know, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but certainly not in the circles that I move.
Are you going to think more carefully about how you interact with your colleagues and other members of staff that work at Parliament?
No, I'm not going to change the way I operate with other members of my staff or other MPs in any way, shape or form. I mean, as mentioned, I treat everyone with respect, and I expect everyone, you know, in this place to treat everyone else with respect. You know, everyone who is working in this building plays an important role in ensuring, as mentioned, that the wheels of democracy keep turning. It doesn't matter if, you know, where you sit in parliamentary services or where you sit in the political hierarchy. Everyone deserves to be treated with respect.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Minister, and thanks for filling in for Minister Little. I really appreciate it.
Much appreciated. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you very much.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.